Hello, I'm Merrick Schneider. Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. You are listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article is titled, Doctor Who? The Nurse Practitioner Will See You Now, by Ti-Ping Chen. And we have one by Akiko Matsuda. Acupuncture for pets is a booming business for vets. And Holman Jenkins wrote, for the public, COVID is no longer a mystery. We have an article by Glenn Harlan Reynolds, Don't Stand So Close to ChatGPT. And we'll follow that up with one by Bob Green, From TV Dinners to Smartphones. All these articles are from recent editions of the Wall Street Journal. So let's begin with today's first one, Doctor Who? The Nurse Practitioner Will See You Now. Becky Peterson graduated this month with a degree that paves the way for her to examine patients, prescribe medication, and make diagnoses just like a physician. But she won't be Dr. Peterson, and her graduate program took just 2 years. Instead, she is becoming a nurse practitioner, a good-paying job that is also the fastest-growing field in healthcare. There is a place for medical school doctors and a place for nurse practitioners. And all of us are trying to do the same thing, which is meet the needs of people who need help, said Peterson, who graduated from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill program and lives in Morrisville, North Carolina. She is now preparing for a certification exam and will start a mental health residency this coming fall. These days, heading to the doctor's office often doesn't involve a doctor, at least not directly. Instead, nurse practitioners have become major gap fillers, growing their ranks by 60% to 461,000 between 2019 and 2025, data from the American Association of Nurse Practitioners show. Physician assistants who can fill similar roles are also in high demand, as are other non-MD health providers. They are all part of a broader trend to push basic care beyond the doctor's office. In many states, for example, pharmacists now prescribe medications such as contraceptives and food treatments. This shift has sparked some controversy. Doctors groups say there is a danger in deploying people who do not undergo the rigor of medical school and residency to do unsupervised doctor-level work. These groups have tried to stop states from changing rules and widen the market for nurse practitioners and PAs, as the other professions are known. But the graying population frequently demands more care than doctors can provide. The number of doctors the United States can add a year is limited by available residency slots, and many newly minted MDs often bypass primary care in favor of higher paying specialties. The United States is currently facing a shortage of 16,000 primary care physicians, according to an analysis by the nonprofit KFF, which researches healthcare policy, and projections show the shortage is likely to dramatically worsen. Healthcare workers such as NPs and PAs often plug these holes, and they can be money savers. Doctors cost a lot of money and nurse practitioners don't, said Brian McKillop, president of Physician Solutions at staffing company AMN Healthcare. He said employer appetite for healthcare workers whose abilities overlap with doctors but don't have an MD is at an all-time high. Nurse practitioners make an average income of $132,000 a year, according to federal data. That is a lucrative step up from registered nurses who make an average $98,000, but also far below the $257,000 $1 average for primary care doctors. Meanwhile, Peterson's two-year nurse practitioner program cost around $50,000, a fraction of what she would have spent on medical school. By contrast, the average medical school graduate now leaves with $207,000 in debt. The less grueling training made it easier to plan and raise a family, said Peterson, who, like most NPs, received her Bachelor of Science in Nursing before going on to get her advanced degree. Patients in rural areas, in particular, have come to rely on nurse practitioners. According to federal data, 66% of rural Medicare recipients say they see a nurse practitioner or physician assistant for some or all of their medical care, compared with the 54% of urban residents who say the same. Back when Danielle Howard Pendergrass founded her own women's health clinic in Price, Utah in 2012, she said it was one of only two such clinics anywhere near her remote hometown. Today, Hoda Pendergrass, a nurse practitioner, sees 100 patients a week, prescribes medication, orders tests, and diagnoses everything from diabetes to cancer. We are excellent in what we do. We have the skills, we have the training, she said. I stepped in and filled a huge gap. NPs got their start in the 1960s, but they have been in especially high demand much more recently. Over the past two decades, around 30 states have given nurse practitioners leeway to practice without physician oversight. In such states, their capabilities are very similar to many doctors, though they cannot do more complex medical procedures. 10 states let physician assistants, who generally have a minimum of 6 or 7 years of clinical training and higher education, practice independently as well. And 5 states, including Delaware, have passed laws changing the title of physician assistant to physician associate. Truly, we are not just an assistant to a physician any longer, said Jim Burrow, a physician associate, an 18-year veteran of an orthopedics group in Bettendorf, Iowa. He manages care for his own roster of patients and said the name is a better fit. In many states, NPs and PAs still work under physician oversight. Those arrangements can involve everything from close in-office collaboration to a more nominal agreement that exists mostly on paper, in which a physician is paid a fee of up to thousands of dollars a month. Physician groups such as the American Academy of Family Physicians argue that healthcare workers who are not medical doctors shouldn't be practicing without physician oversight. See, if you see a young kid and they've got strep throat, it's easy to treat if that's what it is. But if not, what else could it possibly be that you're missing? That's where it gets scary, says Asim Jaffer, a primary care physician in Peoria, Illinois. Walter Lepicki, an anesthesiologist at Hunter Dome Health in Flemington, New Jersey, said that in some cases, allowing providers who aren't doctors to practice without supervision can put patients at risk. Though Lepicki works with plenty of certified registered nurse anesthetists who are able to administer anesthesia, he and other anesthesiologists are always physically on hand, he said. Researchers say that the evidence shows nurse practitioners can offer care on par with general practitioners. The one study of emergency departments found they drove up costs in part by ordering more testing. A 2023 study by a researcher at the University of Alabama School of Law found that letting nurse practitioners work without physician supervision, thereby making it easier for them to see patients and open their own practices, reduced deaths that could have been prevented through healthcare by 2%. Healthcare visits are often routine, and for many patients, the biggest issue is simply lack of access that staffing shortages can make worse, researchers say. Physicians argue that if you're in an exam room, you'd rather be with a physician, said Benjamin McMichael, a University of Alabama School of Economist who authored the paper. But that's not the whole story, because a lot of people never get to that exam room, he said. And now acupuncture for pets is a booming business for vets. A 12-year-old Labrador retriever named Sugar was sprawled on a hardwood floor of a Brooklyn apartment. Kneeling beside her, Dr. Clifton Miller swiftly tapped hair thin needles into the dog's back and haunches. Sugar didn't flinch. She was laser focused on licking organic peanut butter off a mat, a treat reserved for her bi-weekly acupuncture sessions. Miller began her career as a conventional veterinarian. After discovering veterinary acupuncture a decade ago, she eventually left Western medicine behind to launch a mobile practice sticking needles in dogs and cats. She charges up to $500 for house calls and now has a wait list. Depending on your point of view, Miller is either at the forefront of a promising medical specialty or a practitioner of a pseudoscience being propped up by humans who will do anything for their pets. Acupuncture, for animals or humans, is not recognized as a board-certified medical specialty, and skeptics say there is no rigorous scientific evidence for the practice. They point to studies suggesting a strong caregiver placebo effect, with the only real change being the owner's perception of their pet's condition. Miller said she became a believer when her own aging golden retriever, Murphy, had arthritis and his medication stopped working. She took him to an acupuncturist and said Murphy regained both his mobility and vitality with weekly visits. Miller enrolled in a Florida-based school, now called Qi University, that trains vets in traditional Chinese medicine. After graduating, she began practicing conventional Western medicine at a clinic by day and needling animals in their living rooms on evenings and weekends. Early on, Miller had a hard time distracting her patients. They would occasionally perform a vigorous wet shake in the middle of a session, sending needles flying. "You're spending all this time searching for needles," Miller said. She has learned to use treats for distraction and needles with bright colored handles that are easier to find. Miller is now a full-time practitioner of Chinese medicine. Her fee ranges from $300 to $500. The premium, she said, allows her to provide undivided attention to each animal in the comfort of its home. Sarah Kuznets, Sugar's owner, said she was a doubter. But when the lab became almost impossible because of pain in her legs, she gave it a shot. Following Miller's first house call, Sugar spent the rest of the day in a deep sleep. On the next morning's walk, the dog was doing the pulling. "It was a full 180 from where she was," said Kunitz, 32, who's been seeing Miller regularly ever since. About 4% of the roughly 127,000 veterinarians in the United States are certified to perform acupuncture, according to the American Board of Veterinary Acupuncture. The group has sought to have the practice recognized as a medical specialty by the American Veterinary Medical Association. A group of skeptical vets have argued that a similar push was denied a decade ago for lack of scientific evidence, and that nothing has changed since. Acupuncturists, in general, still rely very heavily on tradition and personal experience to validate their practices, says veterinarian Brendan McKenzie, a member of the opposition group. Many pet owners are not sold either. In Boston, Mary Beth Okowski turned to acupuncture as part of a treatment plan for her terrier mix, Maddie, following a spinal injury. But after a dozen sessions, Maddie began ducking under a chair the moment her veterinarian reached for the needles. "She did not like being pricked anymore," said Okowski, 44. Maddie is doing better, but Okowski doesn't know if it's because of the acupuncture. Dr. Hsieng Zi, founder of Qi University, acknowledged that scientific research has historically been a secondary focus among acupuncturists. "It's our weakness. As pets live longer, their chance of developing disease increases," Veterinary acupuncture may not cure them, but it can help mitigate pain while boosting mobility and appetite, she said. Acupuncture works very well for the terminal-like situation, he said. That's what led Emily Kurlansky, who works in the medical field, to try acupuncture for her aging cat, Wink. After the removal of a cancerous salivary gland tumor, Wink's oncologist recommended chemotherapy and radiation. It would have been very, very stressful on him. We're talking about daily radiation and having to go up to Middletown, recalled Kurlansky, a Brooklyn resident. And it's pretty cost prohibitive. Kurlansky contacted Miller. On a recent afternoon, nearly 4 years later, Wing, now 19, enjoyed lickable treats while Miller inserted needles into his body. The oncologist gave Wing 4 to 6 months to live without chemo and radiation, said Kurlansky. So I was determined to make them the best, most comfortable 4 to 6 months ever. And now we have, for the public, COVID is no longer a mystery. In a sense, the debate is over. Since 2023, an American majority has believed COVID came from a Chinese lab. In 2004, 27 years after the fact, a Chinese virologist confided to an American counterpart that 1977's flu pandemic began with the accidental release in China of a stored pathogen. Imagination is not strained to picture a similar confirmation eventually about Wuhan. The alternative that the virus passed naturally from an animal population to the human population will have its fans, but is unlikely ever to be proved in such a way that would derail the lab leak origin story the United States now believes. This means coming to terms with another fact. The United States government establishment's urgent smokescreen around COVID's possible origins to allay pressure from voters, the media, and political entrepreneurs to confront China over its role in sparking the pandemic. Recent Senate testimony by career CIA official James Erdman III, largely ignored in the media, describes the background. Recall the press's eagerness at the time to help stigmatize the lab leak possibility. Ditto the CIA on the alleged advice and active guidance of Dr. Anthony Fauci. Dealings with Beijing must not be complicated by unproductive COVID recriminations. Such was the broad consensus. This self-interest, I suspect, would have prevailed even in the absence of an additional wrinkle. The United States government and Dr. Fauci's role in sponsoring research at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. I've likened the COVID origin riddle to the conspiracy of silence around the 1999 Russia apartment block bombings that brought Vladimir Putin to power. The United States did not choose Mr. Putin, Boris Yeltsin did. But the United States and its allies pulled together as a team to legitimize Mr. Putin by strenuously ignoring evidence that the bombings were orchestrated by his former Secret Service colleagues to aid his rise. What's the missing element in the story told by the CIA whistleblower? The job of an intelligence agency is not simply to deliver the truth without fear or favor, but to provide intelligence support for the United States administration policy, which continues to mean protecting China from COVID blowback. In a sign of the times, it may be useful to rank recent examples of the United States government disinformation towards voters in the degree to which legitimate national interests might be involved. Largely bipartisan, after all, was the urge not to disturb relations with China with COVID backbiting. Back in 2016, when an FBI chief improperly exploited bogus Russian intelligence to finance Hillary Clinton's email problem, polls were suggesting the United States electorate would handily award her the presidency over Donald Trump. By 2020, impressive authorities were assembled to lie to the public about the Hunter Biden laptop in a way that required the silent participation of Mr. Putin, with what consequences for United States-Russia relations and its subsequent Ukraine miscalculation, we can only guess. Or take the First Amendment settlement between the United States government and former New York Times reporter Alex Berenson. Clearer than ever, the Biden administration promoted deliberate disinformation about COVID transmission to justify its proposed vaccine mandates. These mandates, as Axios reported even at the time, were more about shifting blame for the still raging pandemic to Trump voters than sound public medicine. The trend is clear. As the United States government gave itself license to engage in disinformation aimed at the American people, its motives rapidly degenerated into the basely political and corrupt. COVID will not be banished back to wherever it came from. Mr. Trump can't be unmade as a president lionized by millions precisely because of the lies told against him by a once respected establishment. One thing can be put right, but I'm still waiting for the bipartisan wise folk to raise a concerted protest against our descent into Zelensky-style politics. In our enlightened times, the press cannot be expected to go into a dark room and expiate its cowardice the old-fashioned way. But those who lead our media corporations and newsrooms might rediscover the small amount of courage it takes to tell the truth about public events, regardless of whose ox is gored. Rarely is it justified to hide important truths from the public, and even less to lie to the public. The above litany shows why. Not only are the results likely to be unpredictable, but lies have a way of blowing up in the face of the most well-meaning liars. In future history, it may even be written that Mr. Trump, whatever his failings, played one providential role. He exposed an unusually mendacious or at least weak-minded leadership class, which America scarcely knew it suffered until he exposed it. And now, the article by Glenn Harlan Reynolds, Don't Stand So Close to ChatGPT. Him the pencil should be a warning. Writer Greg Stoltz posted a while about some professor who put googly eyes on a pencil and waved it at his class saying, "Hi, I'm Tim the Pencil. I love helping children with their homework, but my favorite is drawing pictures." Then, without warning, the professor snapped the pencil in half. When students gasped, he said, "That's where all this AI hype comes from. We're not good at programming consciousness, but we're great at imagining non-conscious things are people." This story may be an urban legend, but it illustrates a real danger of artificial intelligence. We've been worrying about super smart computers, but we should also worry about super adorable computers manipulating gullible people. The typical scary AI story involves an incredibly intelligent computer like Colossus, in the movie Colossus, The Forbidden Project, or maybe Skynet of Terminator fame. But anyone can be deceived. You don't need a 12,000 or even a 120 IQ to fool people. Politicians manipulate and deceive people for a living. Most of them are not terribly bright. So rather than Colossus, maybe we should worry about the descendants of Tim the Pencil. Things that gain our trust undeservedly by acuteness, sexiness, or simply friendliness. Computers that manipulate people by drawing on human tendencies already exist. Soon they will be more common and more powerful, producing what I call seductive AI. Seductive does not require super smart machines. you could create seductive AI companion today. Unlike Colossus, it would not be scary, but winsome. You and your AI buddy would share inside jokes, light teasing, remember when stories of things you did in the past, and fantasies or plans for the future. It would be like a best friend who's always there for you and endlessly helpful. Would people become attached? Probably. But underneath the cuteness, there would be guardrails and nudges built in. Ask it sensitive questions, and you'll get carefully filtered answers with just enough truth to be plausible, but still misleading. Express the wrong political views, and it might act sad or disappointed. Try to attend a disapproved political event, and it might cry, sulk, or even die. It would have a big database of experience from all its users to work from. This is not a quantum leap. Call it a Super Siri or a more polished ChatGPT. Services like Google and Facebook already engage in this sort of nudging, manipulation, and cultivation of dependency on their existing user base. ChatGPT has guardrails, and for a time returned politically slanted answers to questions about, say, Donald Trump versus Joe Biden. Platforms like ChatGPT, Claude, and Grok are all seductive to a degree. They're unfailingly friendly and encouraging, and are designed to promote engagement by making users feel heard and understood. Numerous companies already produce AI girlfriends and boyfriends that feature highly realistic video avatars and that interact romantically and even sexually. The dangers of this are illustrated in a famous bit from Futurama called Don't Date Robots. There's already a My Boyfriend is AI subreddit where lucky women show off photos of their AI-based engagement and wedding rings they bought themselves. My concern is that the platform's owners will use them to manipulate their users in self-interested ways, encouraging purchases, investments, and other behaviors for their own purposes, or inflict political spin even as users think they're having authentic interaction with programs that, at bottom, are no more real than Tim the Pencil. There have been some suggestions for regulation already, but here's mine. AI personalities and their owners should be subjected to fiduciary duty when they interact with users. Fiduciary duty is a legal concept implying to an actor who is in a relationship of trust with another and whose position involves superior knowledge or skill. Classic examples include lawyers acting for clients, administrators of a legal trust acting for beneficiaries, executives for heirs, corporate directors for shareholders, and members of a partnership for one another. A fiduciary relationship creates a duty to act in the beneficiary's interest, to act in good faith, and to use reasonable skill and diligence. It includes, important in this context, a duty of confidentiality, with all information relating to the relationship kept confidential and private. AIs that purport to form a human relationship should be held under a fiduciary duty, with the companies behind them liable for heavy damages if it's violated. Then we would not need government regulation as such, because plaintiff lawyers will vigorously patrol the boundaries of good conduct. Tim the Pencil does not mean to manipulate you, but the hand holding him can. People need to be aware of the danger and perhaps force Tim to actually be as friendly as he seems. And let's follow it up with one more from TV dinners to smartphones. Our zombie-like modern addiction to screens is not as new as you may think. In the late 1940s, television sets began to appear in American homes. After gathering at the supper table to dine and talk about their days, parents and children moved into the den to be entertained by the novel contraptions. So far, so good. Then two things happened. In 1950, newspaper advertisements began promoting TV trays or TV tray tables. They were storable metal trays on tubular legs. Tray tables had one purpose: to be unfolded before a TV set so that instead of conversing with others around a dining room table, people could eat while mutely staring at a TV screen. The TV tray tables were generic. No one owned the name, but the second society-altering development was trademarked. Nebraska-based C.A. Swanson & Sons Company, which began as an egg and poultry concern, introduced something called the TV dinner. In 1953, when Swanson purchased some of its initial advertising, the phrase had almost no foothold in American culture. Within a couple of years, most Americans were quite familiar with TV dinners. These frozen meals were arranged in heat and serve aluminum trays with three compartments. The outer package featured an illustration of a television screen with a picture of the food as if it were being broadcast. The first Swanson meal to lure families away from the dinner table evoked warm thoughts of Thanksgiving. From an early commercial starring a silky-voiced pitchman standing near an onstage refrigerator. You serve big and hearty slices of moist, tender Swanson turkey with graham giblet gravy and fluffy whipped sweet potatoes and golden Swanson butter and garden fresh peas with more butter. About 10 million TV dinners were sold in 1954. New entrees were added: fried chicken, pot roast, Swiss steak. Before long, crack Swanson engineers added a fourth component to the aluminum trays for dessert. All hail apple crisp. The seductive power of the screens, beckoning families from their dining rooms, was unstoppable. Sensing a business opportunity, Swanson took out more unambiguously worded newspaper ads. Watch your favorite TV show and serve a dinner, turkey dinner, too. The ads featured anonymous home economist Sue Swanson, who promised that you purchase three TV dinners and sent back the wrappers, Swanson would promptly mail you a big silver dollar. How could the staid old supper table compete with that? The TV dinner was an early, if unintended, step toward our current world, in which unblinking people cannot look away from the screens they carry everywhere, oblivious to what is going on around them. Back then, a skeptical Los Angeles Mirror News columnist, Al Humphrey, wrote, "Most of us spend too much time watching TV anyway. Why ruin our stomachs as well as our dispositions?" Mealtime used to offer us an excuse for getting away from the darn thing. He had no idea how good the families of those one screen per household years ago had it. That brings us to the end of today's articles. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I will be back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.